Okay, I'm going to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that the time is currently 1:38 p.m. on Thursday, February 5, 2026. Present today, we have Representative Allard, Representative Hannon, Representative Bynum, Representative Co-Chair Schrage, Co-Chair Josephson, Representative Jimmy, Representative Galvin, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Stapp, myself, Co-Chair Foster. And just a reminder, folks can mute their cell phones. And we have invited testimony today from the Alaska Municipal League on House Bill 284. That's the governor's omnibus tax bill. And then after that, we'll take our presentations from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, as well as the Alaska Travel Industry Association. Just a reminder that tonight, starting at 5:30, we'll be taking public testimony for the governor's tax bill. Just a reminder to my staff, we need to figure out just somebody who can give a quick, real high-level overview of the sales tax portion of the bill, whether it's somebody from DOR or it's Mr. Anderson or someone, just to kind of let the public know what the main pieces of that bill are. And then we'll go into public testimony. Just a reminder, we'll be asking folks, just want to make sure that everyone has a chance to speak on the bill. And so we're asking folks if they could limit their testimony to 2 minutes. And with that, thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Nils Andreasen, the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. And if you could put yourself on the record and jump right into your slide deck. I think you've got maybe 20, 21 slides, but I think somebody was commenting or commending you on your ability to condense difficult information into nice, concise packages. So sorry to set the bar a little high, but I have a lot of confidence in you.
Thank you, Chair. For the record, Nils Andreasen, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Municipal League. I will say when I was invited to present here today, my first thought was a Huntrix line lyric, I'm a gear up and take you down. And I want to say that that's not what we're here for, right? That we at AML are equally committed to working with state agencies to address a fiscal challenge that's been outstanding for decades, right? Our members for 20-plus years have pointed to the need for a state fiscal policy. We've developed websites that outline some of our approach. Over the last 5 to 10 years, we've focused on the revenue shortfall that is facing the state. And so when we think of the problem statement that you're faced with, it really is a revenue shortfall, and does the state have the ability to meet its obligations? And when it isn't, what we've experienced during that time is cost shifting to local governments, that local governments are increasingly picking up the burden that would otherwise be the state's if it were had addressed fiscal policy sooner. Member resolutions support a broad-based tax. They prefer an income tax as it deconflicts with current taxation at the local level. They oppose a spending cap, which, as potentially proposed, cost shifts increased amounts to local governments. We support a sustainable permanent fund draw. But ultimately, the goal is similar to what I heard from the committee this morning, a state that's able to fulfill its constitutional and statutory obligations. Here's a quote that one of our members shared with us, that the fairest statewide revenue tool is an income tax at the bottom, and you can read that. The proposed fiscal plan, as you have in front of you, identifies some of the levers available for revenue. It doesn't reference all of them. They're clearly, as was described by the Tax Division earlier today, these are the ones that were selected by the governor as priorities. I think we have to understand what's been presented in terms of trade-offs, that we're looking at what allows the state to fulfill its obligations, what are those what are those tools as they relate to jobs and the economy, what's the public impact, what is resident, non-resident impact, what's the distributional impact, and how do these tools intersect, again, with local government authority. And AML is uniquely positioned to focus today on the sales tax proposal. There are comments here and there throughout on the broader fiscal policy that we can talk at any other point about, but I do understand that the sales tax proposal is a key feature of this. We think about it at a high level in terms of other types of trade-offs, a proposal to eliminate the corporate income tax, which ICER just said has the least impact to jobs and economy. We look at it in terms of a spending cap, which will push state spending now down, even as costs go up. We look at it through the lens of a tax that's utilized by more than 100 local governments. And we look at it, and I think I heard this referenced again this morning, does it address the problem? Does it get you to a state that's able to, that has the revenue in place to meet its obligations? And the slides that I'm going to present reflect the comments and feedback we've received from members. There is a lot of expertise. I'm not a subject matter expert. I will do my best to carry that. We've had legal counsel review this. We've had tax administrators from around our membership review this, and hopefully these comments reflect their perspectives.
I think there's going to be some interest in questions. I think what I'd like to do is do what we did with the Department of Revenue's presentation, which is maybe hold off until the end of the presentation. What I'm thinking is we're already on slide 3 of 21. We've got 1 hour. I could see us arguing all of the different proposals that AML will have, and what I'd like to do is maybe just allow you to put everything on the table first, and then we can start getting into questions. So I do have in the queue, however, at least Representative Stapp, Representative Bynum. Did anyone else have their hand up? I don't see any. Okay, with that, Mr. Andreessen.
So, in terms of a sales tax, thinking broadly, so we understand it to be the second most regressive. We understand it to hit to have the highest non-resident take, maybe. And I do appreciate the work that's gone into ICER's methodology and its research, but also the limitations that they, you know, spoke to when they presented, I think just last week. There's no data for commercial property. There's no analysis of oil taxes and corporate income tax in relation to non-resident take. And I also want to talk maybe here and throughout about the difference between macro and micro. So non-resident take, as defined by ICER, is really it's an averaged amount, right? And so when I look at the community of Tuxuk Bay or Queethluk or Huslia, it's 100%, right? We're not talking about visitor industry in those communities and non-residents making up some difference there. On average, you might get to something around 70%, but that also takes into account that in Skagway, maybe it's 50, right? So residents in different communities are going to experience take differently, and I think that's important to understand. Yeah, there's high revenue potential. I think I saw $830 million, but if the net is reduced by eliminating a corporate income tax, then we have to think again about those trade-offs. Narrower exemptions means a potential revenue increase for local governments, but there are also new exemptions that most local governments don't have that reduce that opportunity. Yes, the state's responsible for collection under this bill. Maybe there's potential for savings, but it's not outlined what that will cost. And, you know, we could talk about cities that don't currently pay for sales tax collection, where that's occurring at the borough level instead, for whom this would be an additional cost. Clearly, administration of a new state sales tax will be challenging for a state that hasn't done that before. And we should recognize that this is a new tax for the largest population areas in Alaska, that we might think of sales tax as being very common, but for the majority of Alaskans, this will be very new and different. And in those new communities, it will be weighed against other taxes that do occur there. It will create economic friction, which I did have to look up and understand it to mean, you know, ways that these new costs, these taxes, slow down economic activity. So in communities where there's a high property tax, There's no differential here with the state tax on top of it that account for that local variation. I want to talk through.
I'm sorry, Mr. Andreessen. I just wanted to note we did have. I forgot to note Representative Moore stepped in earlier, and just wanted to, for the record. So please proceed. Thanks.
So, 10 items that I want to cover today as we evaluate impact, and you can see the charts on the right. So the top one, frequency of sales tax rates, and it's important to note the far left, 59 local governments that don't have a sales tax. I think it was referenced identified in the presentation by Department of Revenue earlier today how we got to an average of 1.82%. That's if you include 59 zeros. That's also if you don't include the dozens of other communities that aren't municipal that don't have a sales tax, which would reduce that rate even more. So we have to be thinking about not averages, but really specific by community, and work through those scenarios. Identify how is this going to impact the people in my district, how is it going to impact current taxpayers or not, in different ways. And you can see how that plays out across jurisdictions. That average, too, doesn't take into account the current stacking that occurs within Kenai Peninsula or Ketchikan. The city plus borough equals a rate that's not reflected in these numbers. I also want to point to the chart in the bottom right-hand corner, the average sales tax as a percentage of general fund revenue by population. So you can see different size population and communities and the percentage that those local governments are collecting sales taxes in relation to their overall general budget. So for some, sales tax is really, really important. For others, it's less important. It's less a percentage. But it has a meaning for each of them, and you know, we'll come to we'll talk about later the impact of a state sales tax and what it might do to local sales taxes along the way. From a technical evaluation of the proposal, there's work to do. I was looking at my legal. I shouldn't read out my legal counsel's opinion on this. I will say I talked to a senior sales tax administration official within our membership and said, oh, this could be a new job for you. He said he wouldn't take it. It's unenforceable. So my job is to work through those things with you, right? If the state's going to pursue a sales tax, you want it to be workable. You want it to be enforceable. You want to make sure that it has all the components that are necessary for it to be effective. You want to ensure compliance. That takes work. It takes investment. It means that you've got to have the capacity within this body and at the state level to really understand how sales tax works and functions to be most effective. Here are just a few examples of where there's work that's needed. Most of it has to do with some of the definitions and citations. But at the end of the day, you want a law that's defensible. And that for sellers who are trying to follow that law, that it's not challengeable in court. And right now, we've got some concern that that's not the case. I did want to flag at the bottom the broad business-to-business exemption categories. That's new and different for most jurisdictions. This would result in a net loss, lost revenue for most local governments. And there was talked about earlier the concept of pyramiding. There are other ways to evaluate why business taxes shouldn't necessarily be included under exemptions. AML administers on behalf of the Alaska Remote Seller Sales Tax Commission, 56 jurisdictions, collection of remote sales tax. We've got a 23-page code that is legally defensible that I compared against this proposed legislation, and for each of these items found the state proposal deficient. And that's not to say good work didn't go into the state's proposal. It just means that more work is necessary, right? We want to make sure that you've got the tools, the knowledge, the expertise on hand to be able to develop this if you choose to move it forward in a way that is defensible. Again, and when it comes to remote sales tax, there's a lot that's changed. And, you know, we talked earlier this morning about Wayfair and its effect on collections within the state. Even, you know, when Wayfair passed, our understanding of how things would work is different than it is today. So we've already moved beyond, in a lot of ways, some of the early assumptions related to Wayfair and now the ability for local governments and states to collect those on those sales. We're, I should say, unique in the nation. Instead of Department of Revenue collecting in a single, simplified, statewide system, AML worked with the Alaska Remote Settler Sales Tax Commission to basically become a Department of Revenue, to be Wayfair compliant, to manage the variability that occurs between jurisdictions, and not just rates, but exemptions and caps and seasonality. It's not true that you have to have all of those the same. What you need is a system that actually manages for it, and we've got that right now. Just to maybe continue a little bit down that thread, I noticed within the bill references to the Multi-State Tax Compact and to SSUTA, Streamlined Sales Use Tax Agreement. GB is the governing board, if you ever see that. But I would just ask you, as you're contemplating this bill, if you were to take further steps, that you would find out more about those and what you're signing on to. Especially for SSUTA, I would say ARSSTC, our sales tax isn't part of that. And there are requirements that do come with that, right? We've got actually a very simplified sales tax system in Alaska. Other states don't, and they've had to negotiate pretty extensively with each other to find some common ground. And when they go out of compliance with that common ground, the Streamlined Sales Tax Governing Board can come after them. And I think a recent article, I think from the Second, talks about sanctions for non-compliant states. So think about what you're getting into when you're joining a national level system like that. I will say that CSPs is a part of SSUTA Certified Service Providers. And you'll want to budget for those. There are requirements that come as part of SSUTA, including addressing requirements, providing CSPs in a database of all the addresses in Alaska and the tax rate that is applicable. And I can talk about how AMLs satisfy that requirement without addressing, but it could be that you're in a good position to do that, and you would have to do addressing for every Alaskan and Alaskan business in the state. One of the big reasons probably for AML to be interested in this topic is that ultimately this is about local autonomy and decision-making. The sales tax in Alaska is local. And part of the reason that it's local is the state keeps to itself the ability to implement a net income tax, right? So local governments are preempted from income tax. Property tax and sales tax are the ways that that we fund local government in Alaska. And that's, you know, to a large extent decided in the Constitution. We're talking about maximum local self-government, liberal construction of powers, taxing authority only with cities and boroughs, which is different than in many other states, where you also see school districts and special districts and special authorities also have taxing authority. Taxing authority in Alaska is only devolved to cities and boroughs. So you want to make sure that if you're intersecting with their ability to collect tax, you're not diminishing what comes as a result. You do see within this bill that municipal exemptions are subordinated to state law. There's no explicit protection right now for local voter-approved exemptions. There's community-specific policy choices like caps, seasonal exemptions, senior exemptions that aren't included in this bill. All of those go away, right? And it's worth pointing out that most of those came because voters said we want them. Voters decide whether there's a sales tax and what rate in communities. And voters contribute to local decision-making when it comes to those exemptions. And the state is saying right now in this proposal, all of what voters asked for in those communities will go away based on our new list of exemptions. I would note that under this bill, municipalities don't have independent audit authority. It's not clear how that should work. There's no ability to initiate the audit, participate in dispute resolution, or prioritize enforcement. And I think this is a big concern that you should weigh, right? How do you make sure that compliance occurs? where 106 jurisdictions have currently been responsible for that compliance. We lose all of that, that neighbor-to-neighbor relationship, that seeing into communities in a way that at the state level won't be possible. You'll lose that in this process. When it comes to local variability, and I can provide a better data set for you, all the different types of exemptions. This is three different spreadsheets and 300 plus individual exemptions that local governments across Alaska have. I include it here just because it's a lot, and that's what you're working to, or that's what you're losing potentially through this. And there are reasons there's that variability. And even in thinking about the reasons for seasonality, we have to think about community by community. What do they need and when do they need it? When are they buying stuff and when are they choosing not to buy things? When is subsistence most active? Is it in the summer when fish are running and when sales tax is highest? Is it in Fairbanks when visitors are most likely to attend visit in the winter when sales tax are lowest? So you really want to fine-tune your sales tax to meet the conditions of the community versus thinking at a macro level all sales tax is equal and applies to everybody at the same time in all the same ways. So 136, all right, maybe not 300. That's a lot still, though. I should read my slides. 136 different types of exemptions across those just 55 local jurisdictions, not all of them across those 55. I wanted to point out caps and why they're there. There's not caps in this bill. Caps are to make sure that local taxability is limited on high-cost items. This is when you're buying a fishing boat or a snow machine, or a car, and it ranges. So there's maximum tax paid ranges in Houston, $10, $720 in Bethel. That's to protect residents from high-cost item purchases that they couldn't afford a tax on beyond that. So you lose that. It also applies, you can apply it to the portion of sales tax in different ranges, so $300 in North Pole to up to $14,000 in Juneau, often specific in some locations to vehicle purchase, but it doesn't. It's not always tied to vehicles. It could include a cap on a single item or by total transaction. 32 jurisdictions of the 55 that ARSSTC collects for have some kind of cap in place. I mentioned earlier voter-approved exemptions, but we just went through this discussion and vote. Here in Juneau, where voters chose an exemption on non-prepared food, essential food, that goes away under this proposal. And senior exemptions may be most interesting in some ways. Senior exemptions aren't common elsewhere in the nation. They are common in many of our, especially coastal communities, but throughout Alaska, where we've placed a priority on elders and seniors and what they've given. And it's not included in this bill. So seniors would be, I think, negatively impacted, especially under this. But local variability matters for a reason. The sunset clause that's in here, it came up a little bit earlier in the Department of Revenue presentation. I just want us to think through, like, what does implementation look like, right? So you've got 106 local governments who currently have a sales tax. They'll go through a months-long process to unwind it, to communicate to sellers that they don't have to follow the local sales tax anymore, defer to the state. You'll have 3,300 remote sellers who have to update their software and systems that have been developed for current collection and that we've got in place. You have 91,000 Alaska businesses that will have to update or purchase software. And I know it was mentioned earlier that it's just the flip of a switch, that it's a POS that just will turn on. That's for one sales tax, but you have to keep in mind that remote applies to inter-jurisdiction sales too. So every seller will be responsible for sales into other jurisdictions and back and forth. So it's not just the one, it's multiple, and that's where it gets really challenging. And it's not true either that all businesses have the same type of POS. So yes, that applies to a restaurant maybe, but it doesn't apply to a legal, a law firm or many services. They're not utilizing the same type of POS, and so you have to think through What is that stand up? What are those upfront costs that all those businesses will participate in that then goes away for the majority of Alaskans when the sunset clause? So we'll build up, implement, and then it'll go away. And all those local governments that will stay the same, businesses will go through a process of unwinding. And at the end of the day, you'll be contributing in this short period of time to continued net out-migration. Another trade-off, right, that we have to think about. Human resources, keep thinking about those scenarios, right? So 106 jurisdictions who pay people to administer their current sales tax, from as little as a 0.2 FTE full-time employee to as many as 6 in some departments. Section 8 of the bill requires some portion of these staff still collect on other types of taxes in each jurisdiction. These are sales taxes that are applied to other things that the state won't collect for, and that you won't have the economy of scale to employ a full enough staff to do well, right? You'll lose some of the compliance that occurs. You'll also, because of 4305-230C, you'll have to retain some staff to inspect the work of the department. So you'll still have to maintain some level of expertise so that you understand what the department is doing in their collection, and that'll lessen the ultimately the impact of savings from that collection. And what looks like efficiency when you bring it all together adds up just to complexifying things in a way that doesn't result in those savings. It's not one-to-one, but maybe it's 50%, and we'll have to work through really what that will look like. You lose the economy of scale, and there's opportunity. 4344-420 allows the department to contract as a field agent, basically, on that tax. Let's figure out what that would look like. Does that mean 106 jurisdictions continue to collect their tax and the state's? Maybe. Maybe you get some economy of scale there. But we haven't had those conversations with the department. And those are the kinds of conversations you'd want to have with jurisdictions that are currently collecting these taxes. We've talked a little bit about remote versus physical. AML currently administers this on behalf of the ARSSTC. Local governments have invested millions in a system that's defensible, that hasn't been challenged, that 3,300 remote sellers have signed into, and that currently collects $30 million in remote sales tax for the 55 jurisdictions that participate. It's streamlined. It accounts for variability. You can have rates, exemptions. What everybody has agreed to is definitions. And if the state agreed to definitions, it could be part of this. It's not true that the state has to take over everything to comply with Wayfair. It has to think differently. And that's crucial to really understand how could we be creative and do things in a way that is responsive to Alaska's needs. Also, I mentioned addressing earlier the way that ARSSTC has worked through that is with the Alaska Sales Tax Lookup. We've invested, again, hundreds of thousands of dollars in a system where an API is available to any of those sellers so they can include it in their sales systems, or any seller can look up what the tax rate and what exemptions look like within each jurisdiction. All of that's in place and leverageable, but goes away under the current proposal. Clearly, there's going to be investments necessary, and when you get to the fiscal note, think about not just what's there, but what's not there. Think through what's going to be required when it comes to training, travel, software, intersection with local government sellers. And I know we don't have a process for a local government fiscal note, but this isn't going to be cheap for local governments to respond and implement corresponding to the next steps that the state might take. Ultimately, it will cost local government something, and we're not sure what the total revenue would be on the other side. It will cost businesses something to implement this, and you really want to get a good sense of what that will look like. The chart on the top, again, average sales tax as a percentage of general fund revenue by tax rate range. So you can see where high tax is very important for jurisdictions. When it comes to revenue and cost considerations, lots of things matter. And I think this is what I've heard most from communities. Like, we don't trust the state to do this well, right? There's prompt payment legislation already where we're talking about delayed payments and reimbursements that can take as long as 6 months. Sales tax comes in daily, and it's managed monthly or quarterly. All the remittance and the collection and the reconciliation occurs pretty quickly at the local level. And we need to have some assurance that it occurs at the same rate at the state. And that's really challenging in this environment. So we need to know that there's efficiency. We need to understand how the state's exemption decisions will impact local governments. And it's not just that it automatically, a narrower exemption list automatically results in more revenue. There's new exemptions there that will decrease currently collected revenues. We don't know what the administrative fees by DOR will mean. And there's no hold harmless or minimum revenue guarantee at all in the legislation. That timely remittance is important. Staff time, software savings, or the continued expense will be important. And work with us on a local government fiscal impact note. And we can work through kind of some modeling about what this will cost local governments. Evaluate multiple software solutions. I imagine the department is interested in utilizing their current. I've seen other proposals that would be less than what the department might do. But look at what's out there. I mean, the world has changed when it comes to software, especially for accounting for variability and the ability to manage multiple different types of taxes within one system. We have to get a better handle on what contracted support looks like, and again, think through what those new exemptions will cost to communities. Local implementation, again, it'll take code changes for 106 city councils, assembly boroughs. They'll go through, their staff will go through, eliminating the things that tie back to the state or didn't. There's going to be all the communications to public and businesses. There's going to be layoffs for current staff. There's going to be retraining. The budget process has to account for more or less and unsurety when it comes to what will come from the state. So all of these things are going to matter, and we just want you to be mindful as you move forward about the complexity of unwinding what is currently a fairly efficient and effective system at the local level. Again, some additional charts, frequency of sales tax rates. And I mentioned before micro matters, and the next slides we'll talk a little bit more when we get to higher percentage ranges for those local governments who have them. It makes a material difference. There are low-key and high-key community impacts, right? There are things that you see that are obvious, and there are things that aren't, that are nuanced. So 72% of Alaskans will experience this as a new tax. The majority of those will experience this new tax on top of a property tax. And what would happen at the local level is you'd have a discussion about sales tax versus property tax, and you would adjust one versus the other. That's what Kenai Peninsula Borough did, and sales tax now funds much of its education funding. But you have those conversations at the local level that a state tax doesn't take into account. 36 communities will see their sales tax move to at least 9%. And that's very different than 1.82, right? It's very different than 4. It's more than twice as much as 4. And for some communities, that tax will be as much as 13%, which is high. Across the nation, that's high. And we need to think about what that looks like in those kinds of communities. We know that people start changing their behavior when you get to a 2 to 3% percentage point increase. And when you get above 9 and 10%, consumer behavior changes dramatically. And so where those communities have a higher tax, they'll be some of the highest in the nation, and they'll be at risk. And this is one of the biggest fears, concerns that local governments have, that local pressure will result in lowering current local sales tax rates, which will diminish the ability for local governments to do the job that has been shifted to them over time as the state's reduced its ability to do its own. So here's a short list of at-risk communities, high-taxed almost exclusively coastal, defined by fishing and tourism economies. They are responsible for ports and harbors, which they picked up and manage on behalf of the state or took over from the state with the promise of continued support for maintenance and construction. Almost all of these have police departments and depend less on troopers. The majority of community jails are in these communities. So these are your high-functioning, have taken on a greater load than many others in some places, and are taxing their people to be able to do that. The state will come on top of this and force, and I think this is the big fear, again, that residents will rebel, right? That residents will say 9% and 10% is too much for us. And the next chance that they have to lower that tax, they'll say no, or they'll say no to a higher or keep that tax. And that's a discussion that happens regularly within these communities. I want to speak quickly to salience and elasticity. Our members know about it because they manage sales tax. And I didn't include in this quote the hell no that was accompanied by it. But they understand that when you hit a certain point, there's a tipping point that consumers, that residents stop their purchasing. They go elsewhere. And you don't have the ability to flee like you used to online, when online is accounted for. So this is where you get into conversations about net out-migration. And it might not be from Alaska. It might be from a high-taxed community in Alaska to another community in Alaska. But you'll start having some of those real conversations. And the concern for communities who already have a high sales tax is that businesses will close. That's their biggest fear. And I think that's valid. The benchmarks that I can point to, 0 to 1%, there's very little change in behavior at the consumer level. 2% residents might start delaying purchases, combining trips, kind of finding more efficient ways to consume. 3 to 4%, you start looking for other options. And when you've got choices around, especially high-cost purchases, you delay or don't make those. When you get to above 9% total, your consumption reductions are persistent. You stop spending pretty much across the board or slow your spending across the board, which reduces your overall economy. And you get that political sensitivity. You get increasing calls at the local level where taxpayers are demanding that the local level decrease because that's the level of government they're going to look to first, knowing that they're not able to address it at the state level. So we'll close with just these last two slides. Is it possible to build a system that protects local variability and adds the state sales tax? The answer is yes. We could work with you to get there. AML members, again, have been supportive of a broad-based tax, but not at the expense of their own decision-making. Is it possible to structure this so the total tax burden is limited? Yes. Again, creative thinking and mindful thinking about community by community, how do we do this in a way that does the least amount of damage? Are there other better revenue options? Yes. Does this legislation need significant work? Yes, to make it more effective and technically correct. Will it materially affect local government's ability to deliver services? Yes, right now. So I think that's kind of a cautionary but also hopeful note. Where it's at right now, it's problematic. Could we work to get it less problematic? Yeah, I think so. I know the earlier comment was there's no perfect tax. We should probably unpack perfect. I think what we mean when we say there's no perfect tax is that at some point somebody pays the tax, right? There's no tax that doesn't impact somebody. Are there ways to mitigate some of those impacts? Yes. I understand, again, all the trade-offs out there, this versus PFD cuts, distributional impacts, and so on. There's lots of revenue options that ICER reviewed that also get you to something like this without doing the same kind of damage that it might to local governments. There are clear consequences for the limiting of local government decision-making. It impacts, ultimately, some communities more than others, and at the macro level, you may not care that 2 and 4 is just fine and $830 million is just fine. In some communities, it will mean something very different than others. It's not just a matter of who pays, but it's all of those trade-offs and the implementation pathways that are very important. Ultimately, the composition of this legislation doesn't address the problem statement. It doesn't address the revenue shortfall that we started with. It doesn't necessarily address the instability that we're experiencing. And it doesn't benefit communities in the long run if it's conditional on additional elements that materially affect local governments. Our mission is to strengthen local governments. Our mission is to improve the condition of Alaska's communities. We need the state in a position to be a partner in that. We appreciate the governor's engagement on fiscal policy. I'm struck that we called for a fiscal policy 20 years ago, and that was probably the best time to plant the tree. Second best time is now. I get it. But also, let's get it right. Right tree, right place, right conditions. All of those things are going to be part of this discussion. AML supports measures that help to address the state's revenue shortfall. But again, not at the expense of local government's decision-making. We're committed to being part of this process and hopefully have provided some input questions, feedback to you today that you can take with you. Back to your constituents as you wrestle with these questions at home and in your continued deliberations within this committee. Thank you.
Thank you so very much, Mr. Andreas. And as always, you've kept it simple and easy to understand, so I appreciate that. Let's see here, a couple quick comments and then we'll go to questions here. You had, on one of your slides, you've got Nome there, and I know that our sales tax is 6%, and so during the summer, if you stack another 4% on that, it's just, it really is shocking to think that the sales tax could be 10% if this were to be enacted. And also just nice to get this perspective from AML because you represent some communities that don't have a sales tax, but also many that do. So you've got experience in these. Your members have probably come to you and said, there's a lot of implications in this. And so what seems like a simple thing really has a lot of things that need to be taken into consideration. We're going to take questions as far as we can. We do have, unfortunately, a hard stop at 2:30, which is in 10 minutes. I do have three people in the queue so far, and that's Representative Scott, Bynum, and Galvin. We'll take as many questions as we can, but when we get to 2:30, I'll pass the gavel off here, and then we'll bring Mr. Andreasen back if we've got more questions. So with that, Representative Stapp.
I think Co-Chair Foster, through the chair to Mr. Andreasen, thanks for being here. And first, I want to say that I'm absolutely shocked, Nils, that you would think that the state government might operate inefficiently and not be able to execute a comprehensive transfer of sales. Obviously, this is the most efficient element of all things ever created among all time, so take over to that. I know I'm obviously being tongue-in-cheek, I agree with you. So, I do have a few questions for you. First one through the chair. I appreciate the presentation. Most of the information that you have presented, I think, is very helpful and good. And the critiques are, I think, quite fair, especially on the legal and the MTC things that you're going to do. Although, I wonder if maybe we're misunderstanding the purpose of the proposal. Because when we talked earlier on the bill, the purpose of the proposal is basically to fund a statutory obligation that we are not currently meeting. So you in your presentation talked about how municipal governments have to make up for the state's constitutional and statutory obligations. This proposal that we have in front of us, it is a tax proposal to meet a statutory obligation that we're not meeting. So my question to you is, if we're comparing apples to apples, is it better for the people at AML who already pay a sales tax to get more on the dividend to offset their sales tax? And what do we think about that? Through the chair.
Mr. Andreasen.
Through the chair, I was hoping not to talk about the permanent fund dividend today. Representative Stapp, I think there's a couple things. One, and you know, we had a member reach out that said, I mean, this is just the state taxing the PFD. So we should think about this in terms of double taxation, right? So one, you could argue that reducing the PFD is the first bite and taxing it is the second. You could argue that. That was member feedback. I think What I would like to see, and I tried to run some numbers, is at what point do you pay more in tax than you get in an increased dividend? And the number I came to was $12,500. Like, for those Alaskans who make $12,500 or less, this proposal would benefit them. And if you make more, then you would be taxed more than you're getting in the increased PFD. I don't know, I'm not an economist, but those were the numbers that I found, and it probably depends on like what you actually get to. But I mean, I think those are the kinds of trade-offs that we're wrestling with, right? And I will say that AML's problem statement is revenue shortfall independent of the PFD, right? So when we say the problem statement's revenue shortfall, it's community assistance, it's school construction, major maintenance, it's school bond debt reimbursement, it's other types of public benefits, it's capital budget. Like, those are the things that we're focused on. That you have another statutory obligation is also out there, but not where we're focused.
And fault, Mr. Kutcher.
Hold on.
Yeah, thank Kutcher Foster. Through the chair to Mr. Andreessen. Thanks for saying that. That's actually part of my second question. So when we're discussing state statutory obligations in the context of AML, we're talking about the statutory obligations that AML kind of likes and not other statutory obligations that are also draws on the state budget. Because again, if we're saying we're failing in statutory obligations, that's community assistance, school bond debt reimbursement, and that's PFD. Those are all statutory obligations. Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. In this presentation, I wasn't picking and choosing. I know what we're focused on based on our mission. I would add senior exemption reimbursement, disabled vet, $100 million. Like, if we're making a list, it's out there. But you're right that there are additional statutory obligations, statutory, that are within, yeah, I'll stop.
And a follow-up, and I'm going to go to two other little items here, Mr. Chair, really quickly.
Representative Stapp.
Yep, thank Kutcher Foster, the chair. Interesting point regarding the multi-state tax compact. We're already kind of a member of that under our C-Corp structure. And I wasn't aware that if we just have a statewide sales tax, aren't we already in the compact, or do we have to do something different to the compact to stay in the compact? And does this bill potentially, unintentionally, take us out of the compact? Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. There is reference to changes to your current MTC, Multi-State Tax Compact, Commission compact, that this bill envisions. I think what the point that we're trying to make is make sure you've looked into that to know what you're signing on to, what's required to be part of it, and how does that affect choices that you might otherwise make, right? Could you do something differently if you weren't? And I don't know enough about the MTC to suggest you should or shouldn't. I just want you to do some due diligence there and follow up with that.
Thank you. Last one, Mr. Co-Chair.
Follow up?
Yep. Thank you, Co-Chair Foster, the chair. I agree with you. I honestly don't know the answer to that question, too. So thanks for pointing it out on the record, because it is something we should think about, because we probably wouldn't want to unintentionally take us out of a tax compact, you know. So lastly, I know we spent a lot of times about talking about local exemptions and things like that. And I fundamentally, I can't speak for the administration, but to me, their proposal is very clearly designed to be low percent, very broad, with very limited exemptions. That's like a very designed policy. So I think that's a feature and not a bug. And if that's a feature, how would AML work with that? Through the chair.
Yeah. Representative Stapp, through the chair. I mean, I think that you could start over, right? Start at the beginning. What are you required by federal law to have as an exemption? Start there. I think there are federally required exemptions that aren't in there that we were actually flagged and you should consider. So start there. And then, I mean, what we would suggest is look through what are the common exemptions that, you know, local governments have that you could start to deconflict. What are important to your constituents? What are common exemptions that, you know, make sense? And you could start working through and negotiating with local governments too around how do we kind of streamline. The best tax is low and broadly applied. So the principle is sound. The fact that other jurisdictions that you're taking over like already have lots more is something you have to work through. And there are new exemptions that local governments don't have that reduce the net benefit from that. So it's not automatically true that there will be new revenue to local governments from this. And you want to work through those trade-offs. So I think start at the beginning, work through what do we have to have, what don't we have to have, what are the options that we have in the middle, and make some priorities based on that.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. If folks can hold on to their questions, I do have in the line, and I will keep this line up here off to the side, Representative Bynum, Galvin, Tomaszewski, and Jimmy for our next meeting. My intent is to bring the bill back next week. If Mr. Andreasen is available anytime next week, even if by phone, if you're not in town, that would be great. Just to be able to have folks ask questions and maybe take our time. There might be more questions from other folks. But my staff will certainly work with you. And so appreciate your being here. So again, we'll bring this bill back up next week. With that, I am going to take it at ease. Appreciate your helping us out here today. And we'll take a brief at ease and we'll go to our next presentation.
Okay. I'd like to start the afternoon hearing. Let's start by doing a little housekeeping. I'm Andy Josephson, the co-chair of the operating budget. We're in the Al Adams room on Thursday, February 5th. It's 2:33 p.m. Present in the room are Representative Ballard, Representative Hannon, Representative Moore, Representative Galvin, Representative Tomaszewski, and myself. And we're going to start with what we have with us, the Alaska Travel Industry Association, then the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, because, and this should come as hopefully no surprise, we spilled over the previous hearing into the afternoon. We may, and partly because of the travel investment of time, we may just take up ATIA today because I have a hard stop at 3:20, apparently, for a subcommittee meeting. So, Ms. Simpson, if you'll come forward, we'll start with your presentation. My apologies in advance to Mr. Woodrow. We may or may not get to your presentation. All right.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Josephson.
Sure.
Thank you, committee members. For the record, my name is Jillian Simpson, and I'm the president and CEO of the Alaska Travel Industry Association. And I would like to thank ASME for sharing or giving me this time today with all of you. And I'd also like to recognize the continued support that this committee has given to our industry over the years, whether it's for tourism marketing or during COVID. So thank you for that.
And Ms. Simpson, we've been joined by Representative Jimmy, Representative Bynum, and Co-Chair Schrage. Thank you.
So I'm going to start by just giving an overview of who we are. I'll be talking about the number of visitors that come to Alaska, as well as the economic impact. I'll be sharing about our marketing budget for this year and the marketing program that we're implementing on your behalf, as well as the return on investment. So just to start, ATIA is the Statewide Trade Association for Alaska Tourism. Our mission is to ensure that there's a healthy and robust tourism economy in Alaska. And we do that through traditional trade association work, advocating on behalf of the industry. But we also wear another hat. We're the official destination marketing organization for the state of Alaska through the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And this is a little bit unusual. Other states usually have a division of tourism within their government, and Alaska used to do that. But 25 years ago, three different entities were joined together to form ATIA because the state felt it was important to leverage the private sector's expertise in delivering the program. So ATIA is a private nonprofit corporation. We're governed by a 24-member elected board of directors that are representing different regions and sectors of the travel industry in Alaska. And within that is a committee, the marketing committee, that experts apply to sit on and guide the tourism marketing program. And included on that committee is Commissioner Sandy. ATIA has 634 members across the state. And a lot of them are small businesses. 60% of our membership have less than 20 employees. So as I said, there's different things that ATIA does to advocate on behalf of the industry and different things that we do for our members, including an annual convention. We administer the Alaska Host and the Cultural Host Program through a memorandum of understanding through DCCED. We have an Adventure Green Alaska program, which is a voluntary certification program for sustainable tourism businesses. But as I'm here today, it's to talk about the destination marketing program on behalf of the state. So let's get grounded in our visitors. So we, in the last couple of years, have had over 3 million visitors come to the state. They spend $3.9 billion directly with Alaska businesses and communities. And that comes from about 40% of them are cruise visitors that are paying into that, and 60% of that spend are from independent travelers. That results in $181 million in revenues to the state of Alaska, generating an overall economic impact in the state of $5.6 billion and 48,000 jobs. I'm just going to do a little bit of a deeper dive into those visitor numbers. If I was here next week, I could give you summer of 2025, but we're still finalizing those. So this is the previous year. But we did have a slight uptick in visitors, a 1% growth last year. And you can see that growth was really driven by the cruise sector with 3.5% increase in passengers that came up to Alaska. Independent travelers actually had a decline last year of 2.5%. And so while we were up 1%, I want to note that U.S. travel is reporting that within the United States, those trips were actually up 2%. So we're not capturing the full market share of potential visitors to Alaska. Breaking that down even further, I just want to direct you to this pie chart. The green pieces of pie represent our summer visitation. So you can see the majority of our visitors do come in the summertime. Winter does comprise 12% of our total visitors, which is very important, in particular to areas in interior and south central Alaska. That 12% number throughout the years has definitely, winter has always been a growing segment for Alaska tourism, and last year we saw for the first time a decrease in the number of winter travelers. When you combine it with our summer travelers who travel independently, and that just means that they are not taking a cruise, so they're either flying here or they're driving or they're taking the ferry. The vast majority of them are flying. That total is 42% of our year-round visitors are independent travelers. And when you look at just our summer visitation, you can see the change in the makeup of those travelers. We've been seeing a decline in market share of independent travelers and an increase in cruise. So our projections for the coming years, I can tell you that even though we haven't officially released the numbers yet, I have seen them, and last summer was definitely flat across the board for tourism. Looking ahead to 2026, I mean, there is some good news when it comes to capacity, and whether or not that capacity will result in demand and bookings, we don't know yet. But there is, there will be an uptick in cruise. We have two new cruise lines coming to Alaska, and we will also have an increase in the number of passengers that will be able to cross the Gulf of Alaska. So they'll be doing those one-way cruises out of Vancouver or Seattle and docking in Seward or Whittier. And so that really opens up the opportunity for those cruise passengers to travel throughout other regions of Alaska. We've also learned that air capacity is increasing, partly to accommodate those additional cruise passengers, but also there's an opportunity for more independent travelers. So that increase is happening in Anchorage, but there was a decrease in the Fairbanks airport for this summer. Comparing that to what U.S. Travel is predicting for the rest of the country, they are still showing another 2% increase in nationwide trips. That could be good. The other information that they have shared is this past year, international visitors to the United States is down 5.4%, and Canada was down over 20%. I'm not sure necessarily how that impacts Alaska necessarily. I think that there's a different perception of lower 48 in the United States versus Alaska, especially when it comes to Canadians, but wanted to share that information with you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Before we leave that slide, slide 8, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Simpson, I represent here in Juneau, so I'm surprised to see that overall, our summer visitors, summer 25, was flat because in our community it kept getting reported that we were so much higher by like 400,000 or half a million, up to 1.7 visitors. So was that unique that we just had more ports of call calling on Juneau, or did other sectors see a big downturn, or were we an anomaly in seeing a big uptick in our visitors?
Ms. Simpson.
Thank you, through the chair. Representative Hannon, that's a great question. Juneau definitely represents, I would say, the community that sees almost all of our cruise visitation. And so we did see the reports from 2025 is that it was a flat, it was flat overall. So with whatever Juneau saw is representative of what's happening in the market.
Just Representative Hannon.
Yes, it's not computing, because what we kept hearing was we had more people coming. They weren't spending more dollars. They were lower price point tourists. So our businesses weren't going, it's great that we've got another couple hundred thousand. We're not making more revenue, but we had more people volume-wise. But maybe our numbers aren't panning out in the total of the season after we look at it and reflect on it, because it kept getting reported in the news here that we were steadily increasing and we were exceeding our projections by, like you said, a couple, 400,000, I think. 1.7.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Hannon. I will have to go back and look at that. I don't recall that being the case. We're able to report per port, and that's how we're able to get our overall visitation number. And so I'm not sure what you're hearing necessarily correlates, but I'd like to follow up with you on that if I could.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Let's go to slide 9.
Thank you. Just getting into tourism marketing budgets in the past, this goes back about 10 years, and it shows that at one point there was an investment by the state of Alaska of $16 million. Through the years, there has been a decrease. Fortunately, during the COVID times, we were able to have a governor-appointed federal grant that supported our industry during that time. The light blue is the state of Alaska investments, and the green is the industry contributions, which are what different businesses buy into to leverage the state's tourism marketing program. And we always put that money right back into the marketplace. So this year, we are operating on a budget of $2.5 million, and we are anticipating just shy of $600,000 coming from the industry. The higher the marketing budget is, the more opportunities there are for businesses to buy into the program. So when it's smaller, there's just less programs for us to offer. So it also decreases the amount that the industry can contribute.
Okay. Ken?
And to talk a little bit about, just to show where Alaska ranks compared to the rest of the United States, tourism marketing is recognized as the economic lever to drive visitation to the state. It's what grows demand. So every state in the country invests in tourism marketing. Some states have a dedicated fund, while others commit those funds just through their general fund. Alaska is definitely ranking towards the bottom of the list. The average state is spending $22.4 million on tourism marketing, which is approximately $20 million more than our current budget. When you look at the overall spend that states are investing in the marketplace, there's over $1 billion of tourism advertising that U.S. residents are seeing. And last year, there was actually an increase of 6% in that market. So it's a very competitive marketplace, and it's very hard to make sure that our voice is heard. I wanted to also just point out through this graphic, why is Delaware in the middle of the Alaska? And that's because we have the same size tourism marketing budget that the state of Delaware has. And Delaware, as you can see, is substantially smaller, but it is also trying to attract visitors from just over their borders, from major metropolitan areas, to drive to Delaware, maybe for a weekend visit. It's a last-minute decision. We are competing to try to get travelers to spend 9 days up here, spend several thousands of dollars, and that usually they're planning up to 9 months in advance. And so it's just harder for us. It's different. It's hard to compare us to other states in the lower 48, but I wanted to put that comparison out there for you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. I appreciate that clearly investment in marketing equals opportunities for all of us and our economy. And what I have a question about slide 9. We're now looking at approximately 30% of the marketing spend. It comes from industry, about 20%, right? About $600K and then $2.5 million. My question is that what other states do? Can you give us a sense of where the funds come from in other states? What percentage is coming from industry to help continue in the marketing?
Ms. Simpson.
Through the chair. Thank you, Representative Galvin. I don't believe it's as high as we are.
At one point, we were able to generate $2 million from the industry, which, again, was when we had a much higher marketing budget. And at that time, I do know that other states were in awe of what we were able to generate, especially since we don't have as many tourism businesses as a lot of them do. But for the most part, their model is to have the state fund the program, and then they execute it. And they'll offer different programs, but I don't believe it's not the same percentage that we are. I'd have to look to clarify, though, to know for sure what other states do.
Okay, thank you very much.
Slide 11.
Thank you. This year, in the proposed FY27 budget, there is $0 allocated for tourism marketing. And I just wanted to note, this is sort of a famous story in tourism, that back in 1993, which I know was a long time ago, Colorado's tourism department was completely eliminated. It went from $12 million to zero. And within 1 year of that happening, they lost $1.4 billion of traveler spending. And so there's definitely a negative impact that can be immediate when there is not an investment in marketing to drive visitation.
Slide 12 and 13.
Thank you. I just want to talk a little bit now about what we do with the investment that's currently being made. And as a destination marketing organization, I'm sure you've all seen this sales funnel. And as the state, we really try to focus our efforts at the top of that funnel in the awareness section to really get as many high potential visitors as possible to fill that funnel and then move them down through continual marketing, messaging them at the right time, at the right place, with where they are in the funnel. But really our focus needs to be in that awareness portion of it so that as they move down, businesses and communities can attract them to, and then convert them into visitors to their towns and their business. And when you have a robust marketing program, you're able to have a really big funnel that is really wide and it's really deep. And I would say right now we're it's a little bit more of the shape of a straw than I would say as a funnel with our investment. But even with $2.5 million, we are making sure that we are focusing in that mid to top area of the funnel. So our target audiences, we overlay them twice with behavioral as well as geographic. And these are based on where we can get the highest return to maximize our ROI. So we're looking at targeting audiences that are already interested in travel, that are very obvious, and then those that are interested in the types of activities that are very specific to Alaska, like aurora viewing, hiking, fishing, glaciers, Alaska Native culture, and cruising. We have picked six geographic markets to also focus on, and this is based on where we've seen return as well as nonstop flight access to Alaska. But in addition to that, we also were able to create a market potential model last year, which has just given us such rich information that we're able to make really detailed data decisions based on it. So a couple of years ago, we did an ad effectiveness study, and we were able to learn what people spend based on if they came here, if they saw our advertising, and what the impact of that advertising was. We were able to also look at where they came from. And so we were able to build this model, which looked at almost 300 different markets in the lower 48, identified their traveling households, and then if we could do a market penetration of 44% of those traveling households seeing our ads, so they become the aware households, how much money does that cost? Then how does that then cause them to be the ones to incrementally travel to Alaska? So it wouldn't count ones that were already coming, but ones that were impacted by our advertising, how much spending they would make in Alaska, and then what that ROI is on our advertising spend, what that ROI is for the state. And so because we have this information, we're able to really fine-tune our decisions. And a couple of things that came up is Phoenix was a new market we've added, one because of all the new flights that are coming to Alaska from Phoenix, but also you can see the amazing ROI on it. And some of this certainly, there's a science to it, but there's also an art to it, right? Are we going to be looking at, should we be prioritizing the media spend? Should we prioritize the ROI on advertising? Should we
prioritize the economic impact. So we look at all of those things. But this model also helped us realize that because we were investing in Seattle as a market and because there already is a lot of brand awareness, that we weren't necessarily moving the needle anymore with our advertising, which you can see. And so we stopped advertising there. So this has been a really powerful tool for us. When we look at our overall budget distribution, like I said, the majority of the spend is on advertising and public relations, which is, really is what is reaching that top of the funnel. We also have a travel trade program website. We do commit a dedicated portion of the budget, which goes into all of these different pieces of the pie, to cultural tourism, because we really want to be making sure that everybody knows that Alaska has been and always will be an indigenous place, and it's really become the foundation of our marketing efforts. And to that, we've created a culture guide that is inserted inside of every vacation planner that is distributed. I will note we did not produce a new vacation planner this year. We're using a previous one. And of course, a lot of the information about traveling to Alaska is evergreen. Just the challenges that we don't have fresher ads from any new businesses or people that have new tours that have been developed. But this is some of our new ad creative that we're currently running now. We're still doing the also known as campaign, and you can see that we feature some of the major marketing pillars of Alaska: Aurora, glaciers, wildlife, culture, and mountains. The other thing that we've done is we took a brand health study and looked at what consumers are also looking for when they choose a destination, and where can we be influencing their decisions just through our advertising. And one thing that we found was that a lot of consumers are really interested in unique lodging, but they weren't aware that Alaska, we have an abundance of that, and we weren't necessarily promoting that as much as we realized we should, hence why we have that igloo in that picture. Additionally, we also wanted to show that we are a wilderness destination, but it can also be very accessible. And so those are the two elements that came out of our research that we've incorporated into our advertising this year. When we look at our media tactics, it is all digital, and we've even had to cut out other digital. There's no streaming anymore. We used to be able to be on Hulu or Disney or Netflix. Before you're about to watch something, there would be an ad about Travel Alaska. There even used to be interactive ads that you could, I've never done this, but I guess you could get an ad on your TV and like interact with it on your computer while you're watching it, that part of the rich media. And we can't afford to do that this year. So we're very much focusing on digital advertising, which is very easy for us to optimize based on responses we get to either the creative or certain markets or certain demographics responding to it. We can then lean in more to that to get a higher response. I want to talk a little bit about our website, travelalaska.com. As you can see, compared year over year, there has been a decrease in the number of visitors to the site, and certainly that is driven by less advertising in the marketplace. But the other thing is our organic traffic is going down too, and that's due to AI search. Both of those have an impact. Less traffic means that there's less businesses on our site that are getting referrals, there's less orders for the vacation planner, and there's less email sign-up. So it's harder for us to we're not converting as many people to the program because of that. So one of the things that we're doing this year is we're making a really big investment in shifting our content strategy to be able to be better positioned for AI bots as they're scraping sites looking for answers. So right now, traditionally, what's happened, people will go into Google, into a search engine, they type in something, and depending on keywords and the content that we've produced on Travel Alaska, it will show up, and then people will click on our website. But now with AI search, those AI bots are just scraping different websites, and if we don't have our site configured in a way that makes it easy for them, then they're not going to be pulling our information, which we are the authority on Travel to Alaska. So we want to make sure that we show up right away. And so we're working on that just with the way that we're organizing the content. We're addressing it the way somebody would put a question into AI, that where's the best place to view the Northern Lights? We want the answer to be Alaska and not Norway. So we're rewriting our content to be able to address that. We're also restructuring the back end of the site because there's other structural components that make a difference as well. But in addition to what's happening on the website, AI also looks at okay, are you really the authority? Let's see, are there other third-party platforms picking up that you know what you're talking about? And that means that we need to have a very strong PR program to make sure that our voice is recognized elsewhere, whether it's in media, it's on social media platforms, or it's on things like TripAdvisor, that they're saying the same things and pointing to us as the authority. So because of that, we are continuing to invest in public relations, and we'll continue to do that. For this year, our goal is to generate, working with travel media, travel writers, editors, and assisting 250 of them at least in order to produce great stories about Alaska. We want to have placement of at least $25 million in advertising equivalency in earned media. And one of the key ways that we do that is through an annual program we put on called Alaska Media Roadshow, where we bring together travel writers and different tourism businesses in Alaska where they can directly pitch those stories. And it has been an amazing pipeline in order to generate great coverage of Alaska. We also work a lot on social media just to make sure that we're present on channels very consistently, and we've been able to maintain a high engagement rate, even though it says 3%, which seems low. It's actually high for a destination social media page. We also partner with influencers and what we call cultural ambassadors. That's part of our cultural tourism promotional efforts, where we work with Alaska Natives locally who have a pretty strong following, and we partner with them to share content and for them to be able to tell their stories and their voice to our followers. We also work closely with the travel trade. Those would be travel advisors, travel agents, tour operators, and our goal is to help them package and sell trips and itineraries to Alaska year-round. We do that by finding them at different national trade shows. We bring them to Alaska on familiarization tours so they can experience the state firsthand. And we also have an online training program called the Alaska Certified Expert. This year, we're going to a few less trade shows than we normally do, and we're hosting a few less people. But we do have a big event happening in Fairbanks next month called the Amazing Alaska Experience, where we're bringing travel advisors here to Alaska. They'll be able to tour around in wintertime and then have one-on-one meetings with our members. And we also have a small presence overseas. We do have a representation office in Germany to represent Alaska in all of German-speaking Europe, which is Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. And that office primarily works with the travel trade and with media in those markets to keep Alaska top of mind, as well as to support those nonstop summer flights that come over the pole into Anchorage. We do have a small program also in India, which I know might be surprising, but that is actually one of the fastest growing markets to the United States and to Alaska, and it really brings a lot of value. The cost to it is pretty minimal for the return that we're able to get because of the exchange rates. So we do have a small investment there as well. These are just a report of our key performance indicators for the marketing program. Last fiscal year, we had a $5 million budget last fiscal year. And so you can see the effectiveness that the program has, and we monitor all of these really closely, and we're very proud of the return that we're able to offer on the program itself. But we know that the real return is the impact in Alaska, the actual visitors. So as I mentioned, we have done an ad effectiveness study a few years ago, and what we found is that those who saw ads that we placed about Alaska were twice as likely to visit Alaska than those who didn't. And so this is clear indication that marketing works. We're able to bend that curve of who would come to Alaska. We're able to bend it to make more people come to Alaska because of marketing. And those that were influenced by those ads were 71% of them were independent travelers. The other study that we just did last year that was on our brand health also gave us some information on what's called the halo effect. And so certainly our goal when we place these ads is to attract visitors to come to Alaska. But there's a halo effect that extends beyond that, that our advertising doesn't just impact visitation, it also impacts people's perceptions of our state. And so people who saw our ads responded that they were 80% more likely to view Alaska as a good place to live and twice as likely as a good place to start a business or a career. So there's a higher interest in investing in Alaska by those who've seen tourism marketing ads. Lastly, I just want to share the Circle of Life slide with you, which shows the how we all work together, that the reinvestment that the state has made in tourism marketing generates more visitors, which then generates more spending in Alaska and economic impact and, again, higher revenues to the state. And so our ask is of that $181 million in revenues to the state. $15 million of that comes from the vehicle rental tax, which is paid by independent travelers. In fact, 70% of the total amount of the vehicle rental tax comes from out-of-state visitors. So a reinvestment just of that 70% is $10 million, which is continues to be our ask. And I want to recognize that there are a lot of challenges and there's a lot of things that you are juggling right now. And we want to work with you to find that right investment to bring, continue to keep Alaska in the market and in the game and bring visitors to the state.
Ms. Simpson, thank you for the presentation. So $2.5 million in FY26, the board and you are asking for $10 million in FY27. And the governor has nothing in the budget currently?
That's correct, Rep.
Okay.
Yes.
We can take quick questions, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like you to get right to the question. So if there's an identifiable quick question, Representative Hannon, then we'll go to Bynum.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Ms. Simpson, the $15 million vehicle rental tax, that's the total vehicle rental tax that is correct, that number that you're bringing here?
Through the chair, yes, Representative Hansen, that is the total that includes what residents are also paying.
Right.
Okay. Representative Bynum.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justison, through the chair. I was just going to point out that we do have a statute, 4352.080, that specifically outlines this tax for vehicle rentals, and this says we may appropriate it for this specific purpose. And so I've not been a big fan of taxes for no purpose. This tax is for a purpose that then brings direct economic growth to our communities. And I know that you put in here in your slide about the amount of money coming into Alaska and how it directly impacts our communities. Can you talk a little bit about or briefly mention disruptions in the economy, U.S. economy, and how that might overall impact people's spending when they do come to our communities?
Ms. Simpson.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Bynum. Yeah, that's a great question. Certainly, leisure travel is probably one of the quickest things to be disrupted when there's economic concerns. It's the first thing that people pull back from. What we have seen is U.S. Travel has been doing a lot of reporting on this, and they have seen that people are holding back on their spend, but there's still a high intent to travel. I think, fortunately, people in the United States feel like that's, they're entitled to that, which I think they are as well. When there are travel barriers like that, which there always, there's always something, certainly, whether it's the economy, or different regulations, marketing can help address those barriers and help overcome them or at least be another avenue to try to fill that funnel and try to bring in more visitors. So we become much more susceptible to that when we have low or no tourism marketing funding.
And my follow-up would have been exactly that question through the chair. Thank you for bringing that point up, that the more we put our name out there, the more competitive we become, that people will come here as opposed to someplace else if their budgets are limited. So I appreciate you pointing that out. Thank you.
Representative Tomaszewski, then Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Joseph, through the chair. Thank you for being here, Ms. Simpson. Oh, it's always great to see the travel industry, if nothing less than before these nice pictures of bears that we hope the tourists don't try to pet. So 3 million visitors last year. What's the sweet spot? How many visitors can Alaska handle? Is there any kind of estimate on that? I mean, we only have so much infrastructure. So how many do you think that we could handle a year?
Ms. Simpson.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Tomaszewski. That is a fantastic question. I don't have a specific number in mind, but I do know that Alaska is very vast and that a lot of our communities are looking to the travel industry to be able to grow and support their own local economies. And so I do know that we have a lot of room to grow. Part of it is going to be, you know, dispersing where those visitors go, but I think there's a ton of opportunity. And I honestly, right now, I do feel like the sky is the limit.
All right, thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Joseph, and through the chair. We all are familiar with the vehicle rental tax, and my question is pretty specific. Are we certain that around 70% of those who are renting cars in Alaska are from out of state, are visitors or travelers that we would guess would be affiliated with the work that you're doing?
Ms. Simpson.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Galvin. Yes, we're pretty close to certain on that. It's based on a number that McKinley Research Group, back then it was the McDowell Group, had found when they did a pretty extensive visitor profile survey, and they've applied ratios to that. And that's also how we determine our visitor volume when we look at airline passengers come into the state. We're able to apply that ratio as well to those, and that's how we're able to determine, and we're very close with that. We've looked at over the years if that ratio has changed, and it's been fairly consistent over the years, so I would say we're confident in that 70% number.
A follow-up?
Quick follow-up.
Thank you. Appreciate that guidance. And then the other piece is if you have any comment on cultural tourism as it relates to what you know the market is internationally.
Ms. Simpson, briefly.
Yes, thank you, through the chair, Representative Galvin. Cultural tourism is definitely the fastest growing sector, and is something that what we've seen is all travelers are extremely interested in it. But you're right, in particular, international visitors. In particular, out of Europe, I would say that there is a very high interest in indigenous tourism in Alaska, and we've been able to see a growth in that through different opportunities that have been offered now. But I think that there's a long ways that we can still go with that. There's great opportunity there.
Ms. Simpson, we're very grateful to you. Thank you for your presentation. It's good to see you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Mr. Woodrow, our committee, sorry.
I get it.
Our committee rewards patience. So we're going to start your hearing, and we're going to likely finish it. Okay, so we're going to start. If you'll come on up.
So you were going beyond 3:20?
I'm leaving in.
I'll hold it.
Okay.
So we got the rest of the afternoon.
Mr. Woodrow. Good to see you again and identify who you are. And welcome. If you'll put your name on the record, you can begin your presentation.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson and members of the House Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Jeremy Woodrow. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Seafood Market Institute. And can I confirm the amount of time I have for my presentation today?
You likely have in the range of 40 minutes.
Oh, okay. Okay, great. I won't run through the presentation that fast then.
Okay.
Appreciate that. So thank you again for having me here today. And it's a pleasure to follow up behind Alaska Travel Industry Association. You'll hear some similar touch points when I talk about the work that ASME does in our work. And it's great because I think the work that ATIA does and the work that ASME does complements each other very well. So in today's presentation that I prepared for you today, I will go over a brief overview of who ASME is as an organization. We'll cover a few slides on ASME's budgets. I'll talk a little bit about the current status of the seafood industry's economic state, and then we'll go over some of ASME's marketing goals, and I'll share a few tactics of how we're meeting those goals as well. So for those of you who are familiar with ASME, and those of you who might be seeing this for the first time, ASME is the state of Alaska's official seafood marketing arm. We are a public corporation under the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. We're established in statute to maximize the economic impact of the Alaska seafood resource. We do this through building and protecting the Alaska seafood brand, developing and creating markets for Alaska seafood products worldwide, and we work very closely with the Alaska seafood industry to do so. Our ASME is governed by a 7-member board of directors that are appointed by the governor of Alaska. Those 7 members are made up of 5 processors and 2 commercial harvesters. We also have several ex officio members made up of members of the legislature and members of the governor's administration. The ASME board has also created 9 board-appointed advisory committees. These advisory committees are made up of commercial harvesters as well as members of the processing sector, and this is to help advise the board on marketing needs in different sectors of the seafood world, as well as our different species that are commercially harvested in the state. And so while we might have a 7-member board that really directs the ASME staff what to do, we have a broader reach on who we listen to from the industry to make sure the work we do is closely aligned with industry's needs. ASME's mission, as I said, is to increase the economic value of the Alaska seafood resource. We do this by increasing the positive awareness of the Alaska seafood brand. As I said earlier, we work really closely with the seafood industry to do so. We are always championing Alaska's sustainable management of our fisheries. We have proactive as well as responsive marketing to make sure that we're meeting the market needs as well as our industry's needs at the time. We provide quality assurance and technical information to the industry to help them with those issues. And as any state agency, we have prudent and efficient fiscal management. It's important that the work that ASME does return a good investment back to the state of Alaska and to our fishing industry and our communities. In large, the work that ASME does targets retail and food service promotions. We advertise. We do traditional advertising as well as public relations, of course, social media. We provide access to U.S. purchasing programs through our food aid program. We also, as I said, provide technical resources, and we also advocate on behalf of the industry to make sure that our seafood is receiving fair trade and fair access to markets globally, both here in the U.S. and abroad. This helps create additional value to our seafood resource by, one, creating a price premium over our competing supply, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a later slide. We also help reduce inventory when we have inventory backlogs within our industry, and I'll talk about that in another slide, too. And then we also, through our promotions, help create incremental sales, get products out in new markets, introduce customers to new markets and new products as well. ASME's marketing activities are divided into 5 main verticals. We have international marketing and domestic marketing programs. As I mentioned another time, seafood tentacle program. We have a communications and a public relations program and our global food aid program, which primarily targets government purchase programs through the United States Department of Agriculture, but there are some other programs out there too. If you were to look at ASME's budget current year, FY 2026, and compare it to the budget request and the governor's budget for FY 2027, you'll see that they're fairly similar. And the ASME receives, in general, 3 different pots of money when it comes to our revenues on any given year. The seafood marketing assessments, which was reflected the statutory designated program receipts, that is what's paid for by the industry. It's a self-assessment. It is set in statutes, but the industry has the ability through statute to vote this number up, down, or out, you could say. Right now it's set at 0.5% of ex-vessel value. For those of you that might not be familiar with what ex-vessel value means, ex-vessel value is that first sale that happens from a fisherman to the processor. It could happen at a tender, it could happen across the dock, but it's that first sale that happens on all the fish that's commercially landed in Alaska. It's shown here in both FY26 and FY27 to look fairly similar in numbers. So just to let you know, for budget purposes, that includes some carry forward in ASME's budget, but it also includes some authority as well because we receive that revenue in quarterly payments the Department of Revenue collects from the industry. It's actually paid for by the processors, so it's kind of interesting. It's based on ex-vessel value, so it's what the fishermen are paid, but the processors collect that and they pay that to the Department of Revenue. ASME has been very successful in recent years in increasing the amount of federal funding we are receiving as a state agency. The vast majority of our federal funds come to ASME through USDA Foreign Agricultural Service. Because they are federal funds, like any other federal funds, they come with strings attached. And since these are through the Foreign Agricultural Service, they require that these federal funds be spent overseas. And I'll go into the size of our international program in a later slide and talk about what we do overseas as well. In the FY26 budget process, ASME also received a $5 million unrestricted general fund appropriation. That was actually as part of the FY25 supplemental, and it was a multi-year appropriation. We actually were able to spend a little bit of that in the closeout of FY25, and so we don't have a full $5 million to start FY26 with, but we will be spending the majority of that that $5 million appropriation in FY26. And we're very appreciative of it, and I'll show you how that impacts ASME's budget in a next slide. Lastly on this slide, you'll note that our total budget for FY26 was about $31.4 million. You'll see that our spend plan is much lower than that. That is a very common practice by the ASME board to ensure that we have enough funding to start that next fiscal year with in the bank. Like I said, that statutory designated program receipt, some of that is authority, so that's not realized until that money comes in. So we must start each year with some of that SDPR in the bank so that we can actually start our marketing activities on July 1. If we were to break our FY26 spend plan down by those program areas I showed in a previous slide, you'll see that about 30% of our budget goes toward the domestic market. This includes our global food aid program, because that targets the USDA. It includes our communications and PR program, as well as our food service and retail promotions. Just under 60% of our budget goes to the international markets. That 14% of SDPR, well, that's our industry match. That's what ASME is matching those federal dollars that are coming from the USDA Foreign Agricultural Service. You'll see that the pie of federal dollars is for international market is fairly large. It wasn't that large a couple of years ago, but that has increased in recent years, and it should stay pretty high moving forward. And the reason we know that is in the One Big Beautiful Bill that was passed this last year, there was an increase of the Market Access Program. The Market Access Program is a competitive grant program. ASME is considered a cooperator or a commodity board. And if you're to look at it in the simplest of terms, we compete against U.S. beef, poultry, pork, citrus, California almonds. I mean, the list goes on. There's about 100 plus of different groups that apply for these funds. Well, that program was doubled in the One Big Beautiful Bill. And so our access to those funds, which had been stuck at about, and actually I'll share this slide because it'll almost be easier to look at, it was about $4.5 million consistently, and that's the green bar you see here in this graph. As you see moving forward, we expect that to be increased. Whether it's going to be doubled, we don't know yet. Those funds are pending. We're waiting on those awards to come through. They were delayed because of the government shutdown in the fall, so they're behind schedule by about a month to 2 months or so, and when we should know these amounts. This is great, though. This will allow us to do more in the international market. Though, like I said, it doesn't require us to match that with our industry funds. While we're on this slide, we'll talk a little bit about where ASME's budget has been, where we're going. You'll see that there's been a little bit of volatility in ASME's budget the last few years. We've definitely had volatility in the seafood industry, and so that impacts ASME's budget. When the industry is having impacts, such as ex-vessel values going down, ASME's revenues also go down. You can look at FY20 as a great example here. That blue bar represents the statutory designated program receipts, or this market, the assessment that the industry pays to ASME. That was one of our lowest years. Actually, I think it is our lowest year on record. COVID year was awkward for everything in the state. It was challenging. I would probably be agreeing with a lot of my industry members that they're just happy they fished that year. And so we are happy that they were able to fish as well, too, and keep some revenues and keep product going and continuing to feed Americans and feed people across the world. One of our challenges that ASME has, though, and if you look at starting around FY22-23, you notice that our revenue started growing around that time. We did receive some CARES Act and some ARPA funding, which allowed us to increase our spend plan. But what happened in fiscal year 22, and actually what happened in calendar year 22, was we had the largest return of sockeye returned back to Bristol Bay. And I'm sure this is not news to everyone in this room. I don't ever want to say that we have too much fish, but it created a challenge, and it came at probably the worst possible time for the market. what was coming, what was happening in the world at this time was we were seeing soaring inflation. Consumers had a lot of free cash, right? Because we were coming out of COVID, and so they were spending at an all-time high. The market was incredibly confident going into calendar year 2022 summer of this fishing season. It's safe to say at this time that processors paid too much for those fish. Fishermen, they did really well that summer. Processors, however, got stuck with a lot of sockeye salmon that they could not sell because spending from consumers worldwide came to an automatic halt around midsummer to that fall. That fish became really expensive for processors to hold on to. And when you're holding on in cold storage, you're paying for that. You're asking a bank to also give you a loan to continue to pay for that fish to hold on to it. And so what happened was the price of fish started coming down because the market, frankly, wouldn't buy the fish at the price that processors paid them for. Also at this time, Russia decided to invade Ukraine. To fund that war, Russia started offloading its fish in the global market at rock-bottom prices that we, frankly, couldn't compete with either. Fast forward another year to summer 23. We had a large pink salmon return. Processors told fishermen, stop fishing. We cannot afford to buy your fish and sell it at a cost of zero. That's how expensive and how low that Russia was selling its fish in the global market. What happened in those 2 years was one industry came to ask me and said, we need your help. We need to sell this inventory of sockeye because if we can't sell sockeye, we can't sell anything else. So the ASME board at that time said, all right, we have no other choice. We got to dip into revenues, and we got to increase our spend plan and help move some of the sockeye. And so that's why you see our spend plan go up, and that's the blue dotted line in 23 and 24. We got to a high. Well, unfortunately, our crystal ball was cloudy at the time. We didn't realize that ex-vessel values would start crashing at that same time, and that's what happened in 24, 25, and we're seeing that in 26 as well. And so our revenues and our carry forward kind of coming down a little bit. We know this. That's why we're forecasting out to FY32. Our job is to make sure we manage our budget prudently. And so we do have a spend plan where we need to get down and kind of get our budget to align with our revenues. And that's what our goal is by around 31, 32. This is just another way kind of to look at what happened with the industry the last few years. And I think looking at the ex-vessel value is just a great comparison to see. We were in a moment of stability from 2015 to 2019. We'll say COVID year was an anomaly. Things looked good in 21, and you can see the wheels start coming off in 2022, and it came to a crash in 2024. Hopefully 2024 is rock bottom. Things looked a lot better last year, but these are still preliminary numbers. A lot better is still not where we need to be. And I wouldn't say that we can say that we've, you know, gotten out of this hole until we see multiple years of consistency. And consistency is what our processors, is what our fishermen, it's what really the entire state needs to say, okay, we have a very important part of our economic engine working again. That said, looking at the seafood industry and how it's doing, if you look back in 2023 and 24, right? Now I'm just going to go back really quick to slide 10 again. These are our two lowest years in the last 25 years, right? The industry still contributed $5.2 billion to the state's economy during this time. On average, that's usually closer to $6 billion, a little bit over, just to put that in comparison. That's an average per year, so that's not total over that time. Fishermen's, obviously, their ex-vessel values were down. As we saw in the previous slide, they only got an average of about $1.5 million. These are still big numbers, but they're not as good as they could have been or should have been had we not gone through the challenges that the industry saw in the last few years. Alaska remains the major player when it comes to U.S. seafood production in the U.S. Almost two-thirds of all seafood produced in the U.S. comes from our state. However, in the global scale of it, we're about 1%. And that global production includes aquaculture as well as wild capture. So we definitely, I think we fight above our weight class when it comes to the global economy, but we still have our own challenges as well. It'd be easy to say that you can find a commercial fisherman in every single Census Bureau across the states. Of the 19,000 fishermen that fish in Alaska annually, about 58% of them are Alaska residents. That represents about 11,000 fishermen. It's no surprise to me, but might be a surprise to some, that you'll find the majority of those fishermen in our population centers, especially in Kenai Peninsula, Anchorage, and the Mat-Su. That represents about almost 3,000 of those 11,000 fishermen. though you also find quite a few of them in our fishing ports, in our popular fishing ports, such as Kodiak, Dealey, and Amsica, round out that top six. The industry contributes about $125 million in annual state, municipal, federal taxes and self-assessments each year. That's paid by both fishermen and the seafood processors. So I've talked about the challenges of the industry. We're not out of this hole yet, so what's ASME doing to help the industry out and move us forward? Well, last year, the ASME board directed staff to focus on three main priorities. Our first priority is to capitalize on the Russian import ban and increase the U.S. market share of Alaska seafood here in the U.S. Our second priority is to increase the Alaska seafood brand recognition of key species. The species are Alaska sockeye salmon, pink and Kita salmon, as well as sablefish, pollock, and surimi products. And our last priority is to differentiate the Alaska Certified Seafood International Program as the preferred origin-based certification program in the U.S. And that's to counter the Marine Stewardship Council eco-label, which continues to certify Russian products in the global marketplace. If CSI is a new acronym to you, and I'm sure all these acronyms are because that's the world we live in, CSI was formerly known as the Responsible Fisheries Management Program, or RFM. It got a rebrand in the last year because it's gone global and it's having more fisheries being certified in a global scale instead of just here in the U.S. The reason why countering the Russian seafood is so important is, one, we compete with Russia nearly one-to-one. Every fish we catch, they catch too, right? We share an ocean with them. However, they don't operate on the same scale as we do. They don't operate on the same fair trade practices as we do, or the labor practices. Because of the way that they manage their fisheries and where they process their fish, they undercut us in the global market, and it's only fair that they shouldn't be able to undercut us here in the U.S., which is our most important market for Alaska seafood. In 2023, in December of 2023, by executive order, Russian seafood was banned from entering the U.S. marketplace. It was actually done by two different executive orders. I won't bore you with word soup here. But that ban went into place, and there was a grace period for importers to still bring in Russian seafood. And we knew for a fact that they put together as much inventory in those 6 months by the time it got to when that full ban went in place by May of 2024, that would hold over that inventory for about 18 months. Fortunately, in April of last year, President Trump extended this executive order, so the ban is in place. It has to be renewed each year. But we are starting to see the effects of that ban really starting to come to the marketplace now. This last fall, going into this winter, we are getting phone calls, we're taking emails, we're taking business meetings with those companies who were prior bringing in Russian seafood, going, okay, the spigot's been turned off. I'm now buying Alaska seafood. Let's have a conversation on how we can promote your product and talk about Alaska seafood to my customers. So we're making a difference, but we need that to continue on. So that's why we're really happy to say that House Fisheries Committee passed HJR 29 out of committee this week. HJR 29 supports a continuation of that ban, and ASME is fully supportive of HJR 29. We hope that moves to the legislative process so we can send that resolution to our delegation in D.C. as well as the Trump administration officials so they can continue to support the extension of this executive order.
And Mr. Woodrow, just to keep us on track here, it looks like we've got a little more than 10 slides, and I would guess about 10 minutes before we start losing members en masse. So just to keep you on the ball here.
Appreciate that, Chair Shragi. I will just last comment on this slide. While Russian seafood is removed from the U.S. marketplace and it's created a large void to be filled by Alaska seafood, our competitors in other countries have all identified the U.S. as an opportunity for growth because there's no longer Russian seafood there. And so our competitors from Norway, Chile, Iceland, and farmed whitefish from Southeast Asia have all said, let's go to the U.S. too. So we have competition. So this market is not just going to be given to us. We have to fight for it as well. So what do we know of the American consumer? Well, we know that, yes, they are price sensitive. We saw that in 2022. Seafood is inherently expensive. And so they're telling us, well, calm down a little bit on the pricing. However, the second claim that is most motivating to the point of purchase for U.S. consumers when it comes to seafood is that wild-caught claim. It's music to our ears. We've spent 40 years telling consumers that wild seafood from Alaska is a premium fish, and that's the fish that they should be reaching for. So it shows that our marketing is working because, right, we're 60% of the U.S. seafood. That means they're reaching for Alaska when they're making that purchase. And we know that because when we drill that information and this research down even further, when we use Alaska or the Alaska Seafood logo on packaging, consumers have told us they're 80% more likely to purchase that product. Even more so, they've said 78% of consumers have said that they're willing to pay more for that product as well. But on the previous slide, I just said they're price sensitive, right? And then here they tell us that they're willing to pay more. So how much more are they willing to pay for that product? Well, our research shows that the price premium that we get for Alaska branded products on average is about 15% more. That's a 15% difference, and I'll talk about that on a later slide. That comes back to our processors, our communities, our fishermen, and the state. So how do we talk about Alaska seafood, and how do we reach consumers? Well, it starts with our public relations and earned media program. You'll find this in every single major publication, whether it's print or digital. A lot of times we tell the Alaska story, just like our friends at ATIA do. The Alaska story is a great captivating way to get people to lean into Alaska seafood. We tend to do this through trusted sources and trusted names, such as seeing the top screen there with Martha Stewart and Marcus Samuelson, with one of our favorite resident Alaska fishermen, Hannah Heimbuck. Our consumer PR and social media did a great job in 2025. Influencers continue to drive a lot of our social media impressions and engagement. But if you look at that number in the far right there, our earned media coverage still outweighs impressions. Over 7 billion impressions in 2025 alone just through earned media. So that pitching, that everyday storytelling is really important to capture our viewership and our audiences to get them into the store for Alaska seafood products. So once we get into the store, what's the path to purchase? Well, as often as possible, we're trying an omni-channel approach. This is an example from 2023, 2024, when we had to move a lot of sockeye salmon. Costco is a great partner. Costco sells a lot of sockeye salmon. I can't share the numbers because that is confidential, but let's just say they sell a ton. And actually tons. This is a great example of an omni-channel promotion where here we are touching them in multiple different points before that consumer even gets to the aisle. We're accessing them online, on the Costco website, the Costco Connection magazine, on the TVs, the first thing you see when you walk into every business center, as well as the in-house and warehouse email catalog. This is also, when they get to the aisle, they don't have to go, is it farmed or is it wild? They just go, I'm going straight to sockeye salmon. And it works time and time again. And so we've been really successful with sockeye salmon. But like I said, Russia is no longer in the marketplace. So we have an opportunity to elevate other species. And we're starting to do that with pink salmon. And if you were to go to your local grocery store 2 years ago and you just went into the canned seafood aisle, you would have saw a majority of that canned pink salmon just called out as Pacific pink salmon or wild pink salmon. If you go there now, I guarantee you the majority of that will say Alaska pink salmon. It has to, because it's coming from Alaska. And so this gives us an opportunity to really elevate one of our lower value species and bring more value back to it to Alaskans. So we've created, our marketing team has put together and created a package that our retail and food service partners can use for pink salmon and tell a better story around pink salmon, especially Alaska pink salmon, leaning into the value, the versatility, the convenience, and the healthy aspects of pink salmon. We're just starting to see these new assets roll out, and I'm excited to see how these continue to build value for pink salmon. But like I said, we need time to do it, right? We have that ban. We need that ban in place. Lent starts up here in a couple weeks. That means that your favorite fast food chain is going to be carrying a crispy fried whitefish sandwich. Why is this important? Well, McDonald's alone sells a quarter of all of its Filet-O-Fishes in those 40 days. That's an impressive amount of Filet-O-Fish is sold in during that time. I'll continue to just highlight McDonald's here. McDonald's has been a great partner. When we try to partner with these different programs, we give them a little bit of dollars to get them in, make sure they're using the Alaska Seafood logo, calling out Alaska Seafood products. We are now on digital signage for McDonald's nationwide, which is showing those customers throughout the year that Alaska Seafood products, they're seeing that touch point over and over and over, and we don't have to give them any more money to do that. That was an initial spend, and that's usually what we see with these partners. You see that value, that strength in the Alaska Seafood brand, we get them in, and then they'll continue to carry the Alaska Seafood brand year after year in their promotions. I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about the international market quickly. The international market, you saw the size of our program budget in an earlier slide. It's important because still about 65 to 70% of our product by value still goes overseas. If you look at this slide, the best way to interpret the map here, green dots are where ASME has active marketing programs. The red dots is where Alaska seafood products go, but ASME does not have active marketing programs. South Korea is a big outlier here. South Korea is primarily a cold storage transshipping destination, so a lot of seafood goes there, but it just is held there in cold storage and then moved on to further destinations such as Japan or to Europe. The best way to think about what species are exported versus what stay here in the U.S. is I like to look at it as our high-volume, lower-value species tend to be exported, such as pollock, Gita salmon, a lot of pink salmon tends to go overseas. What stays here in the U.S. is usually our lower-volume, higher-value species, king salmon, king crab, halibut, for instance. There's a few species that cross kind of both lines there, such as sablefish and sockeye salmon. There's enough volume, and they kind of strike that balance of value and volume. Because our international funds have increased, ASME's international portfolio has also increased. We are now in over 55 different countries with 10 different international marketing programs. So we have contractors overseas who work on our behalf in those markets. They're in-market experts to do marketing on our behalf. I'll just share with you just a couple international examples to get us through the slides here. Here's one example from a couple years ago with Family Mart. If you're not familiar with Family Mart in Japan, it's a convenience store. They're similar to 7-Eleven. I think an easy way to compare from maybe a U.S. Analogy would be if 7-Eleven is Starbucks, there's one in every corner. Family Mart's more like Dunkin' Donuts, there's one in every other corner. This promotion, particular promotion with Family Mart in 2023 was specifically selling ikura and tarako, which are salmon and Alaska pollock roe, onigiri. Onigiri is a rice ball. You'll find them in every single convenience store in Japan. They're delicious. I highly recommend that's the first thing you buy if you ever go to Japan. In this 25-day promotional period, we're in 7,500 of their stores, over 3.5 million servings. We had a video playing in the stores during the same time that was seen over 3.8 million times, and it generated about $7 million in U.S. sales. We invested only $56,000 to generate those sales. That's an incredible return on investment. So good that we did another promotion with Family Mart just this last year. And this promotion, we changed it a little bit. We added more products. There were 7 Alaska Seafood logo branded items in the store with our digital signage. We timed it with the Japan Fishery Agency's Good Fish Day. I don't know why it's over 4 days, but they called it Good Fish Day. We were targeting evening shoppers, so busy lives, coming home after work or trying to find something quick to eat, going through the convenience store. The numbers are still preliminary, but the preliminary numbers were that we had ad impressions over 14.2 million times, generated about $18 million in U.S. sales, and sold a total of 14 million unique Alaska seafood products during this promotion. 7-Eleven is a great, 7-Eleven and Family Mart are great partners. We've done a really great job calling out the Alaska seafood logo in both of those convenience stores. Family Mart is actually coming to Alaska this summer. CEO actually wants to come to Alaska because he's so bought into this promotional program and how successful it's been. And it actually means a lot to us to have them investing so much into our state.
And Mr. Woodrow, love to see Alaska seafood being marketed so well. We are at about the time I was hoping to stop. I can go another 5 minutes before I have a very hard stop. I know we've got at least one member with a question or two. Would you like to blast through your last couple slides and take some questions, or how would you like to proceed with your 5 minutes that you've got?
I'm going to take 30 seconds on one last slide, and then I'll take questions. That works, Chair?
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Woodrow, please continue. Okay.
All right, last slide for you. Last year, ASME conducted an ROI study. We'll make sure that our dollars are going as far as we say they are. The key points from that ROI study are that, one, for every dollar we get from either the state or the industry, return that into $1.82. ASME works very closely with the industry, and these returns would not be possible if it wasn't for our partnership with the industry. And so that's why when we say we generated a $464 million return in 2023, why we want to take credit for it all, we can't take credit for it all, but it is the partnership created with the industry that using the Alaska Seafood logo, calling out Alaska and being very strategic where we put our efforts, we're able to generate more value back to the industry. Our budget in 2023 was about $20 million, so to see a $464 million dollar return back to Alaska and the industry really shows that our work is doing what we say it is.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much for that. Representative Bynum, I know you had a question.
Yes. Please. Thank you, Co-Chair Schrage, through the chair. Thank you for being here definitely good to see our products being marketed around the world and in the United States. I don't want to get too political, but one of the things that comes up that I get asked quite a bit from my community members, a big fishing community, Ketchikan, Wrangell, they see these types of programs happening, and then they see us putting money in through UGF dollars. And I understand you have federal dollars coming in, you have industry-paid dollars going into this, but then we, from time to time, add additional dollars. And they see those dollars going in, and they feel they're frustrated, I guess, in the sense that they see that there's these large, large commercial fishing boats that are doing fishing that is very controversial right now in Alaska. And then they're out there and they're small handliners and power trawlers catching king salmon and other fish. And they see that marketing going out for those big corporates, companies. And then they know that we're spending our dollars here. And so I get the question of why in the heck are you guys funding them? And so I was hoping that maybe you could talk a little bit about maybe that whole idea of I was hoping maybe you could level that for me so that I have a good response to my constituents, because I just don't have a good one, other than I think it's good for Alaska that we're marketing our products.
Right. Mr. Woodrow.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I know exactly what you're talking about. I'm not blind. I know that the controversy that we see in some of our commercial fisheries in the state of Alaska. I'll say for one, you know, ASME's job is to market and not to manage our fisheries, right? And so we aren't trying to get into that political debate. Two, though, that our job is to market Alaska first, and the brand is Alaska. And consumers, they aren't nuanced enough to know how that fish was caught or where. They know where it was caught, not necessarily exactly where in the state of Alaska, but they view Alaska seafood positively. I will say one of ASME's job is to make sure that consumers continue, and it was the very first thing I showed on our mission, is to continue to see Alaska seafood favorably. And so we pay very close attention to how consumers view Alaska seafood holistically, whether it was caught by a small boat hand lining hand trolling in Southeast Alaska or a large boat trawling in the Bering Sea. Our consumers view that the same, and we want to make sure that they continue to see Alaska seafood the same. Thirdly, I should say that we tell the Alaska seafood story through our species. We tell that story through all the different species and all the different harvest methods. Our small boat fisheries are really, when I say that we had 19,000 fishermen, 11,000 of those are residents. Those are our small boat fisheries, right? So they're the backbone of our industry. And it's important that we continue to, when we talk to consumers globally, that they're the ones that we put front and center because they're the ones that matter most to our state.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Woodrow. Really appreciate your patience today and for being with the committee. Thank you for the work that you do with ASME. With that, this concludes our business for this meeting. Our next House Finance Committee meeting is scheduled for today at 5:30 p.m. At that meeting, we will hear public testimony on HB 284, the Governor's Omnibus Tax Bill. Please note, for that meeting, written testimony may be submitted to the committee at house.finance@akleg.gov. That's house.finance@akleg.gov. We ask the public to keep their testimony to 2 minutes to ensure everyone has an opportunity to testify, and of course, longer testimony can be submitted through that email just provided. With nothing else before the committee at this time, we are adjourned at 3:45 p.m. Thank you. Be back.